We have with us live in the studios once again, Ja Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. So some good news this week from, or at least for some, good news coming out of King County Council.
Yes. This week, the King County Executive Dow Constantine announced that two Republicans on the King County Council will now vote for the $20 car tab fee for transit so that it won't have to go to the ballot. Jane Haig and Kathy Lambert finally responded to testimony from numerous folks at the King County Council meeting saying that they wanted the County Council to directly vote for the $20 car tab fee and not kick the can down the road and put the tab fee on the ballot. Yeah. And, you know, they didn't have much choice. They really had to change their vote when the Downtown Seattle Business Association and the Downtown Bellevue Business Association combined with major Eastside companies like Microsoft and other big employers like the University of Washington leaned heavily on them and said, we simply don't know how our employees are going to get to work if bus service is cut.
Yeah, and there was a huge fear, particularly with the dialogue the past couple of weeks around the competing plans for the city of Seattle putting an additional anywhere from $40 to $80 car tab license fee on the November ballot, that very large proposal would endanger both if they were both on the ballot at the same time. So this is a way of avoiding that eventuality and ensuring the very draconian cuts that we've heard about the past few weeks that Metro was proposing will not happen, at least not in that form.
Yeah, but it was only a partial victory because the deal came after Jane Haig and Kathy Lambert managed to force a compromise in Metro's budget. They said, yes, we will vote for the $20 car tab fee if Metro eliminates the ride-free area in downtown Seattle. The car tab fee will raise about $50 million. Eliminating the ride-free area in downtown Seattle will save about $2 million.
Well,
no. A little under $2 million.
Actually, the under $2 million is what they estimate they would get in revenue if everybody who is using the ride-free zone were to pay. But it's not going to happen. A lot of people will use it just to ride a few blocks, you know, to get from point A to point B downtown. They will choose to walk in the future rather than to pay for that.
Those
short
riders
ride.
won't be real riders in the system. That's right. And they threw in a few other little so-called sweeteners. One of them would accelerate the changes in the system, cutting service on some routes that have very few riders, increasing service on routes that have high ridership, and increase service on routes that would go over the tolled bridges 520 and I-90 when and if tolls are imposed on I-90.
And the thought behind that was that a lot of people are going to be more willing to take transit once they have to pay to go over those bridges, which are now free.
Right. And then they also decided to offer for people who will pay the new car tab tax to offer to them $24 in free bus tickets when they pay their car tab fee as an incentive to try to get them out of their cars and onto Metro. I don't know if that'll be successful, but, you know, we'll see.
All right. Moving on then, paid sick leave.
Yeah, the City Council Housing and Human Services Committee this week passed the paid sick leave ordinance. The full council will continue to debate it. They won't vote on it until September because there are some questions about some of the some parts of the proposal that may be changed. For example, maybe imposing a longer waiting period before sick leave is offered to employees in certain businesses. Looking at the requirements which are on a graduated scale. For if you have a smaller business, for example, you would be able to offer fewer paid sick leave days than a larger business, which would have to offer many more paid sick leave days. But what's interesting is that Seattle would not be the first city to institute a paid sick leave ordinance. Washington, D.C. has done it. And San Francisco has done it as well. And a recent study in San Francisco showed that businesses have reported no impact on their revenue or their profits from offering the paid sick leave to their employees, which is absolutely the opposite of what some of the business, example, the Seattle Downtown Business Association and the Greater Seattle Chamber of Commerce are both against the paid sick leave ordinance because they're worried about it impacting businesses' bottom line.
And it's also consistent with previous studies that have been done in the San Francisco experience. So this has been very consistent that it has not been had a negative impact on the business climate down there.
Yes, and you know, last month the Seattle Chamber of Commerce started an email campaign to businesses to try to get them to lobby the city council to kill the ordinance or at least put it on hold until it's been studied to death. But, you know, San Francisco's experience shows once again that it will have a neutral impact on a company's bottom line. But what it really can do is it provides a very powerful, positive impact on the employer-employee relationship that at least that's been the experience in the companies that I've worked for. Having paid sick leave is great for employee morale and for employee productivity. It's so much easier to get your work done when you know you can take an hour and a half to go to the dentist and get your teeth fixed, for example. You know, and you don't have to worry about running into the break room or hiding in the bathroom to call your dentist to try to work out your schedule. You know, you can be much, much more productive, less worry, less stress, and your feelings towards your employer are much less hostile.
Of course, you probably still have to pay for that dentist out of pocket because
yeah.
Nobody covers that anymore. But yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Okay. Developments this week regarding a couple different initiatives.
Yeah, the Washington State Office of Financial Management has been going through the different ballot initiatives that are going to be on the ballot in November and estimating the financial cost to the state of those ballot initiatives. And I want to talk first about 1125, which is the Tim Eymann initiative that would require the state legislature to set tolling authority on different state roads. That's a disaster, according to the state OFM, for a couple of different reasons. Number one, it would basically stop state plans to sell toll back bonds. That's for the new State Route 520 bridge. That's for the 99 tunnel. That's for the I-5 bridge between Vancouver and Portland that's being talked about. That's for future HOV lane expansion of I-405 on the east side. All of those are going to be financed, at least according to state plans at this point, by tollback bonds, and that would be made impossible by the idea that that the legislature is going to set these. The rationale for initiative is, well, tolls are a form of state tax, and this way it would require a two-thirds vote to raise the tolls rather than having it been set by an independent tolling authority. But even more to the point, according to the OFM, is that if 1125 passes, local governments would have to give back somewhere between half or all of the $123 million in federal grants for the 520 program related Metro bus service and King County passenger ferries, because that money was contingent on the DOT agreeing with the feds to use experimental congestion pricing on 520. That congestion pricing has automatic triggers that can't be used if there's a statutory requirement that requires an act of the state legislature to raise those prices. So it would cost the state a lot of federal money to pass 1125.
Well, and I-1125 does away with congestion pricing because it wants to set a flat rate toll if tolls are set. So it really jeopardizes the state's the state's stream of income from tolling is what is the basis for its ability to borrow money to issue these bonds for these major highway projects. And if you jeopardize that revenue, you jeopardize a lot of the things that are very dear to the heart of people like Kemper Freeman and Tim Eymann. So really they're kind of shooting themselves in the head by trying to pass this initiative.
Yeah, Kemper Freeman, by the way, the Bellevue developer who is also adamantly against light rail on the east side. But very pro-car. He is and very pro-free parking, which is, you know, how he's made his fortune with Bellevue shopping centers.
Yes.
He is the main financial backer of 1125. This is not a grassroots, as with the other initiatives this fall, they are not grassroots initiatives. They are almost all being put forward by corporate special interests.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
such as liquor.
Yes, and I want to talk about Initiative 1183. That's the other initiative that the Office of Financial Management released a report about this week. They looked at the potential revenue impact of privatizing liquor sales in the state of Washington, allowing stores with more than 10,000 square feet to sell liquor, and then to remit about 17% of their profit. 17% of their liquor revenues to the state. And what the OFM found was that, well, yes, the state could make quite a bit of money off of this. On the other hand, there's the if factory. The state could make a lot of money if those privatized businesses raise the markup on their liquor sales so that they could also make a profit too. In other words, privatizing liquor sales will mean guess who pays?
We do.
Consumers. Yes, consumers would end up paying much, much more for liquor. The new fees would probably increase the markup for liquor to about 72%, which means what some folks would call a hidden tax of at least 27% on top of the taxes already taken out on
liquor. Yeah, what's the markup now? Do you know?
Oh, God, I don't know. But it's pretty high right now because
of sin taxes. But it's not 72%.
It's not 72%. No, and that's basically what happens when you privatize a state industry. Consumers and customers pay a lot more.
And it's always sold as this will lead to increased competition and lower prices, and it never, ever
does. And it
does.
Never does.
All right. Well, then that moves us on to national and the super committee.
Well, both the Democrats and the Republicans announced their composition for the committee that was created as a result of the compromise over the debt ceiling hostage situation.
And
a
I'll talk
weeks
about
ago.
That in a little bit. Job's going to talk first about Patty Murray.
Well, yeah, I wanted to talk about Patty Murray as being not only the only person from Washington State or this part of the country who was involved in the budget committee. There's a representative from California, but she's the only other West Coast representative. But also out of the 12 members. Six Democrats, six Republicans, six from the House, six from the Senate. She is the only woman. And until the Democratic House nominees yesterday completed the committee, there were no people of color on the committee either. It is a very, very demographically unrepresentative committee, as, of course, Congress as a whole is not particularly demographically representative either. But when you're talking about a committee that is widely expected to focus on budget cuts and budget cuts that will disproportionately affect the most vulnerable populations in this country, it is really, really important to recognize that this is a committee full of millionaires. This is a committee full of older white males. This is a committee full of people who do not look like the rest of America and certainly don't have the personal experiences that most of the people in this country have when it comes to, you know, the stagnant wages and the dependence on government services that people have experienced over the past 10, 20, 30 years.
Or even if you're not dependent on government services, they haven't experienced the housing downturn the same way the rest of us have. They haven't experienced the hidden increases in prices on necessary items like food and clothing.
Well, they're not all that hidden, just in the consumer price index.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, you look at this, at the composition of this panel, and you go, this is pretty much what Congress looks like, but even more so. I want to talk a little bit about the members in total on the committee and what the committee is supposed to do. The committee is supposed to come up with cuts of about $1.2 to $1.5 trillion over 10 years. They have to put a plan together, a plan that at least seven members of the 12-member committee can agree on by November 23rd. Which Congress can then either vote to approve or reject. Congress can't make changes to the plan.
Yeah, and if they reject it, the other triggers automatically come into
effect.
And
if they don't approve it, yeah, by December 23rd, then automatic cuts happen all across the board in the federal budget, including to things like Social Security, Medicare, and the military budget. Now, the composition of this super committee, the Joint Select Committee on Deficit Reduction, that's the name of the committee, half of them are Republicans and half of them are Democrats. Three Republicans and three Democrats were appointed from each House, from the House and from the Senate. Now, I want to talk first about the Republicans. The three Republicans from the House are Jeb Hensarling of Texas, Dave Camp of Michigan, and Fred Upton, also of Michigan. Jeb Hensarling will be co-chair with Patty Murray. He's head of the House Republican Conference. He's extremely conservative. In 2004 and 2005, he proposed caps on Social Security's and other quote-unquote entitlement programs. He's very much on the far right of the party. Also,
is saying something.
Yeah, which is really saying something. The other two members from the House Republican side include Dave Camp. He's the chair of the Ways and Means Committee, which oversees taxes, Medicare, and Social Security. He is extremely anti-tax increases, the kind of guy who would never vote for a tax increase or to close a tax loophole. Fred Upton of Michigan, he's the chair of the Energy and Commerce Committee that oversees Medicaid and parts of Medicare. He's considered a moderate conservative, but he also swings far right in order to get support from other members of his party.
And the way this has been covered in the response to the Republican appointees from the House particularly has been, these are people who are not likely to compromise in any way, shape, or form. Very similar to what we saw over the debt ceiling hostage negotiations.
Yeah. What you would expect from the House Republicans who are in charge of the House and have been the people instigating the anti-tax, pro-cut philosophy that's been running the show in Washington.
Yeah, when you have a committee that is statutorily required to reach some sort of a compromise because it needs at least one member of an opposing party to sign off on a majority document, this is the Republicans saying, we are not going to compromise. We are not going to be the ones to cave on this.
Yeah, and so you might expect a little more maturity from the Republicans in the Senate. But the appointees from the Senate are almost as bad. John Kyle from Arizona, Rob Portman from Ohio, and Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania. Kyle is very conservative. He's a member of the Finance Committee who is very strongly resists cuts in the military. He's the kind of guy who says, no, we must always support our troops regardless of the cost to the budget and the economy.
And in fact, if people remember when the START treaty negotiations were going on last fall, he was the guy who was pushing for a lot of money to modernize, quote unquote, which is to say a new generation of nuclear weapons in order to sign a treaty that would reduce nuclear weapons.
This is the kind of
mentality that he has.
Yeah, he's a nut, and he likes pork for the military. Rob Portman and Pat Toomey, they're both brand new to the Senate, both freshmen this year, which is really a puzzler to me. If you're going to put people on a super committee, you want experienced people. Not if you're the Republicans who don't believe that the committee's work should actually get done. Rob Portman, the freshman senator from Ohio, he was White House budget director under George W. Bush and U.S. Trade Representative. He's considered the moderate. But remember, as budget director under George W. Bush, he's the guy who helped get us into the deficit problem in the first place. The kind of person who would write budgets that didn't include military spending for the war and then turn around and ask for emergency funding for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which helped to put us in the deficit situation in the first place.
And also one of the architects of the Bush tax cuts.
Yes, exactly. And then Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania, he's probably the worst of the bunch. He's a former president of the Anti-Tax Club for Growth. He is an anti-tax extremist. He voted against the debt ceiling bill that created this committee because it didn't cut spending enough. He's pro-free market and limited government, and he wants to lower tax rates even further. He not only will not close tax loopholes or raise tax revenues, he wants to lower them even further. He's also a former House rep who won his Senate race seat with Tea Party backing, so he's really the guy who's supposed to be representing the Tea Party on this committee. So what you have on the Republican side of the committee are people who won't compromise and people who are not interested in looking at the reality of the situation.
And people who don't have a lot of experience in budgets.
Exactly. On the Democrat side, I don't know as much about the House folks yet as I do about the folks in the Senate.
Those were just announced at the end of the day yesterday.
Yeah. The folks in the Senate, you have Patty Murray, John Kerry, Patty Murray of Washington State, of course, John Kerry of Massachusetts, and Max Baucus of Montana. Patty Murray will be co-chair. As Job said, she is the only woman on the council. She's a member of the Senate Appropriations Committee and the Budget Committee, and she's really the person on the committee, it looks to me, to be the person who is the most familiar with the budget and who will have the most knowledge about what will be going on in terms of the, you know, the fine points of the budget. She's also the chair of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, which has got the Republicans up in arms. They don't want somebody who raises money for Democratic campaigns to be sitting on this committee. However, you know, plenty of the Republicans sitting on the committee help to raise money for the Republicans as well. John Kerry, of course, is chair of the Foreign Relations Committee. He was the 2004 Democratic presidential nominee, and he's a negotiator and a big wig in the party, but he's also somebody who can reach compromises when he has to. Unfortunately, the fact that Murray and Kerry can reach compromises isn't, and they're the really the senior members in terms of experience on the for the Democrats on this committee, doesn't bode well for the Democrats holding the line for
The senior people, period, on the committee.
Yes, for protecting social services. Max Baucus, he's the chair of the Finance Committee in the Senate, which oversees taxes, Medicare, and Medicaid. He's very much against the Bush-era tax cuts. He wants to do away with tax breaks for the wealthy, something that you have to do at minimum if you want to balance the budget. He's really the only one on the committee who has come out and who is coming out and saying that strongly. Although I think Jim Clyburn, the Democrat from South Carolina who was appointed from the House, is also very much for ending the Bush era tax cuts.
That said, Baucus is also one of the more conservative Democrats in the Senate.
Yeah, he's considered quote unquote centrist, which means he leads towards the conservative side of the Democratic Party, and he voted for Bush's 2001 tax cuts in the beginning, so he can swing either way. For the House, as I said, you have Jim Clyburn, a Democrat from South Carolina, the only African-American man on the committee, Javier Becerra of California, the only Hispanic on the committee, and Chris Van Hollen of Maryland, who is a member of the House Budget Committee. I don't know very much about these guys right now. I know Clyburn has a lot of experience. He's a good choice from the House because he has some familiarity with what average Americans might be going through right now. And that pretty much wraps up what I was going to talk about in terms of the 12 members of the Budget Committee. It looks like you have these Republican extremists on one side who will not compromise, and on the other side, you have Democrats that may compromise too much. Isn't that representative
vaguely,
of Congress?
Vaguely familiar, yeah.
All right, still a lot to cover. Continuing with the mortgage fraud.
Yeah, the FBI released a report this week showing that mortgage fraud is still prevalent. In fact, it's as bad, they say, as it was in 2008 and 2009. It remains widespread even in a depressed housing market. They quoted real estate firm CoreLogic, which said that more than $10 billion in loans were made with fraudulent application data in 2010. Much of the fraud involves falsifying financial information to qualify buyers for loans that they couldn't afford, exactly what was happening before the housing market collapsed, inflated appraisals on houses so that they would be sold at elevated prices, exactly the same thing that was happening before.
And a direct consequence of the failure to institute any kind of meaningful reform after the original bubble burst.
Yes, and in fact, it's pointing to what we might fear to be a second housing crash coming further down the line when those folks who are getting loans fraudulently now, turns out they won't be able to pay.
All right. Healthcare reform.
Yeah, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in the southeastern U.S. based in Atlanta became the second circuit court this week to rule on the Obama healthcare reform, and they ruled this week that the health insurance mandate was unconstitutional, in direct opposite to the 6th Circuit Court of Appeals in the Midwest, which ruled that it was constitutional a couple of months ago. That means that this question is going to go directly to the Supreme Court, where Justice Kennedy will probably decide the constitutionality of healthcare reform sometime next summer, just before the election. Not good news.
Not good news, no.
And the U.S. Postal Service.
Yeah, also not good news. The U.S. Postal Service proposing this week, basically to privatize itself and bust its unions. They want to cut 120,000 jobs from the Postal Service, about 20%, that primarily being, frontline workers, not management. Now, mail volume is down about 20% over the last 4 years, obviously due to the internet and email and so forth. But the post office would still be, profitable were it not for a congressional mandate that the post office prepay pensions for 75 years for its federal employees' federal pension benefit program. So one of the other proposals by the post office is to separate itself out and do its own pension program rather than the federal program. And of course, this also has the unions up in arms because that would be much less beneficial to its employees. So a lot of this appears to be an artificial crisis triggered by that congressional mandate put in place by Republicans that wanted to bust the unions. And glory be, it looks like that might exactly be what happens.
All right. And downgraded credit rating.
Yeah, we found out quite a bit this week about exactly what Standard & Poor's was talking about when it downgraded the credit union because it thought the U.S. political system was not functional. We saw, for example, in the presidential debate on the Republican side this week, the eight candidates present, none of them even hesitated to think for a moment before rejecting a hypothetical deal which would have had 10 parts cut in budget cuts to one part revenue increase. None of them would even think about accepting that because it included the one-part revenue increase. So you had people like Standard & Poor's Senior Director Joydeep Mukherjee saying that the stability and effectiveness of American political institutions were undermined by fact that, quote, people in the political arena were even talking about a potential default as though it were a regional, as though it were a reasonable option. So you have basically an entire section of the American political spectrum, namely the Tea Party Republican spectrum, that has become divorced from reality. And you have people around the world who are seeing this, and people in financial institutions and the financial world seeing this, saying these people cannot run themselves because you're going to have gridlock as long as you have a large portion of the American political spectrum divorced from reality, running on ideology rather than running on what the real world actually looks like. And that is the pretty pass to which we have come.
Yeah, and you know, you look at the debates in Iowa this week between the eight Republican nominees, and they all are falling in line on this issue. They're all saying, "No, we would never raise taxes to, and we would, you know, even if it meant we could get $10 in cuts for every $1 that we raise taxes in the budget." You know, I mean, that's just insane, considering that at least two of those candidates have done just that in order to run companies or to run a state, in the case of Mitt Romney as governor.
And Tim Pawlenty in Minnesota.
Tim Pawlenty as well. So basically what they're doing is they're not only divorced from the reality of how things operate in the world and creating the separation between the U.S. political institutions and the rest of the world, but they're allowing their supporters in the United States, people who follow the Republican Party and lean to the right, they're allowing them to live in a fantasy world, and they're encouraging that. And that really has a major impact on the American culture as well.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. Can't cover
as usual
riots in the UK.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to the riots next week because I do want
to
talk about those.
Time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Events.
Yeah, a couple of events. We talked a couple weeks ago at the passing of Jackie Hudson, the peace and anti-nuclear activist at Ground Zero who passed away a few days back. There's a memorial for her this afternoon. It is at 1:30. It is at the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action in Kitsap County at 16159 Clear Creek Road. In Polsbo, which is right adjacent to the Bangor nuclear subbase. And bring your walking shoes because part of the memorial for Jackie will involve actually walking to the gates of the base. So that'll be this afternoon at 1:30, and a chance to turn out there and honor a real pillar of the peace community and a truly remarkable woman. And then a reminder also that Tuesday is Election Day. If you have not already mailed in your ballot for the primary election for city and county council races and the tunnel ballot measure and other good things that are on the ballot this this August, please do so. Those must be postmarked by Tuesday, so get those ballots in the mail.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
Well, over the past couple of weeks, we've talked about what our choices are for that ballot, for the ballot measures and candidates for the races this time. And those are all up on our website. That's at www.eatthestate.org. And you also have other articles and comics and blog and all kinds of cool stuff. So check it out, www.eatthestate.org.